I'm a 3D artist focusing on the photorealistic food world. So I do a lot of client projects related to the food industry, creating things for menus, fast food chains, small stuff. And I kind of began my career in the film world. So even back into high school, I was shooting music videos, going into Chicago to shoot like rap music videos. And I was making these, you know, compositions and lighting these scenes before I even knew what I was doing. And I was just like, oh, that looks cool. That looks good. And I was building up my, I guess, resume of lighting and composition. So I went to school for film and midway through got into 3D and immediately noticed that a lot of the principles from the film world translated really seamlessly over to the 3D world. And I think right off the bat, I had a confidence level going into posting things online that maybe I wouldn't have without the film knowledge. Cause I could make things look pretty realistic, even though I wasn't like modeling things the right way at first, I could make things work out. And, come time I graduated, I had a following on social media that was actually bringing me more client work, just as a hobby than I was in my actual field that I have a degree in film and television. And so that's kind of where we're at now, just kind of building that resume and building, you know, the portfolio online, getting more clients in and kind of building a name as a digital artist, specifically in the food world.
Explain the food thing. Like people, whenever they start to do 3D, it's usually, you know, guns or spaceships or something kind of like in that area. And you're in this food segment. How did you get into it?
So the food stuff came, again, pretty naturally. I think I was a 3D generalist for the greater part of my 3D career. And I was always switching series. Originally, I was inspired by people like Beeple and Hood-S. And they were making like those massive landscapes with like objects in the center. And I think after my abstract phase, I got into more environment creation like that. And then it was just, you know, every few months I'd switch it up. And eventually I stumbled upon making characters. And people like that because it was old school nostalgic characters that they used to watch when they were a kid, but I was messing them up and making them kind of gross and grotesque. And that quickly turned into, oh, what if I made the Krabby Patty in 3D? What if I made a purple flirt from Jimmy Neutron in 3D and made it look realistic? And I quickly found out that these things were looking pretty tasty and I think I was executing them pretty well. And when I was like, okay, this looks pretty tasty, why don't I try real food? So I tried real food and I started making a series based on that. And it wasn't just that I realized that this stuff looked tasty and commercial ready pretty fast, but it was that there wasn't that many people doing it in this industry yet. So I saw an opening and I started making this stuff. And before long, people started calling me the digital chef, cooking up all this stuff. And I kind of ran into it. And now we're kind of here building off of that specific niche.
What's the secret to kind of like... stuff looking realistic? I can give you my kind of like perspective, right? So when you think about 3D in general, it's usually easier to do stuff that you're not kind of like interacting with every day, right? So it's very hard to do like a human being because you see a human being every day and it's like uncanny valley is very near and it's like sometimes it just doesn't look right, right? And I guess same goes for like even engineered objects like cars or something like that. If it's a very nice render, if it's all shiny and bright, and there's this one thing off, it's still gonna look like that a total mess, right? With food, I think it's even more challenging because this is the thing that you're basically eating like three times a day. When you look at people who are doing like 3D renders for commercial work, like, you know, like products or something, they're trying to painstakingly take out kind of like all the, you know, all the disruptions, all the mistakes, or all the kind of like iffy things, so it looks like very glossy and right, right? I'm guessing with the food is a little bit different because it's all about kind of like this weird math and a weird look that it's the opposite of that. So tell us a little bit about like how did you kind of like come to understand the what's this tasty look like?
I think that's a good point. I think with the food specifically in 3D, it's like this challenge of finding the middle ground between making it look photorealistic, but also very edible and commercial ready. Because some people make stuff and it's like, okay, that looks like it belongs in the physical world, but it doesn't look tasty, or maybe it looks plastic. So I think it's just nailing down the right mix of lighting and also texturing. I think a lot of people tend to make specifically food look very plastic, or it doesn't have enough subsurface scattering where light bleeds inside. What I found is creating food, almost everything has a bit of subsurface scattering, more than people realize. And that, I think, for the most part, makes things seem less plasticky and more lifelike and organic. But to your point, I would also argue that food, you have a lot more flexibility than even creating hard surface things like cars or humans, where it's like, okay, you have two eyes here, you have a nose, you have things that cannot be misplaced. Otherwise, things look a little off. With food, you would think that it has to be super precise, but in fact, like, let's say you're making a bowl of rice or mashed potatoes, like no two swirls or no two rice grains look perfect or the same. So you actually have a lot of flexibility to get creative there. And that's kind of what drew me to making food as well. Like, if you're making a cheeseburger, like the way the sesame seeds are laid out on the bun, there's no uniform fashion they have to be. It's like, you can just scatter them, kind of play with that. And the more randomized it looks, the better it actually looks.
So what's your tool of choice? Like, you mentioned Cinema 4D in the beginning, but I guess it was kind of like your introduction. Are you mostly doing your stuff in ZBrush these days?
I think I would say 80% of my time these days is in ZBrush, because I started in Cinema 4D and I lightened texture in Octane. But ZBrush, after making a ton of food renders already and building up huge libraries of textures for myself, I hardly have to start from scratch on any textures at this point. I just have different, you know, meat, cheese, Oreo, ice cream, everything kind of built out. And then when I just apply these procedural textures on my meshes, I can just finesse them a little bit, change the absorption colors, change the scattering, change the specular to fit the needs of the specific renders. But 80% of the time I'm in ZBrush learning new ways to create the same thing every single day. And that's where the dailies help. I'm like, okay, I've made fries 50 times before. What would be a fun, different way to make this? And sometimes I'm like, okay, this actually makes way more sense. So I'm learning things in a very specific niche level that most people wouldn't have dove into.
Yeah. So you're kind of like, you got three layers in already, kind of like with this, with your work progression and so on. So in your world, does geometry mean, is it like less important than textures and lighting? It almost seems like you were emphasizing lighting and materials and, you know, the PVR flow a little bit more. So it's kind of, it kind of holds more. I understand that it's probably equal. Both things are important. But like, from your point of view, how do you work on these textures? How did you create this library? Like, what's the idea or philosophy behind it?
I would say I'm pretty unique in the sense to where most people have to worry about, especially people working for games and animations, they have to worry about poly count. They got to worry about edge flow, if things can deform the right way. And I'm in a kind of unique position where I don't really animate that much. Most of my client work, I'd say 90%, 95% is still based. So regardless, if the mesh looks horrible, if the mesh is overly dense, it doesn't matter to the client per se. However, doing this for a long time now, I've had to, you know, I've implemented, just for saving space and time, good ways to remesh. And so it's good to have good topology regardless. Sometimes for very dense type of things like rice and things that are merged together and kind of need to look almost like merged and liquidy, I'll keep them in like a Dynamesh format that, you know, you just slap a procedural texture on. So it's a little bit less important than making sure you have like correct edge flow on a human's knee bending and all that stuff. But a lot of it is in the texturing and lighting. And I would say more so the lighting, you know, cause I did a video recent back. I did a video somewhat recently where I was showing the difference between like good texturing, good lighting, and like kind of breaking the same scene off with good texturing, bad lighting, good lighting, bad texturing, and just showing you, even with the best texturing in the world, if the lighting's not right, similar to the real world, if you just slap a flat light on it, nothing looks pleasing and good. So it's just a mixture. It's finding that balance. But most of my textures, if not all, are procedural at this point. I used to use a lot of image textures back in the day and just like it get really ugly in the nodes. but nowadays it's all pretty much procedural, and that adds another layer of complexity. If I have like 10 chicken nuggets laying next to each other, if I can kind of scatter the same material in a procedural way, they look, you know, not uniform, even though it's the same texture laid on top of each other.
You're saying procedural textures. Are you using substance tools or something else?
I use Substance Painter for some client works, but for the most part, I'm using just Octane materials and combining different types of materials in the Octane fashion in Cinema 4D.
That's amazing. I didn't even know that you could do such things in Octane. How do you like it overall? Like, do you find it's a great tool, like optimization-wise or feature-wise?
I think for someone like me, who's a freelancer who doesn't often have to share scene files and project files with like a bigger group of people, especially over like the cloud or something like that, it works. You know, things like Redshift and other renders like that from Maxon, I think, are a little bit better if you're working in tandem with studios and you got a little bit more flexibility, as they're more biased renders than Octane. Because Octane definitely has things that I think are a little bit limiting, but for my use case, it works perfectly.
Yeah, because I'm looking at some of the images, like we're going to put them in the video, something like when you have like a taco or like fried beans, and those are like almost like a picture, which kind of like drives me to my next question is, how did you start monetizing this? How did you start working with clients, and who are these clients?
Yeah, I think that's the fun thing about Instagram is, since I've built somewhat of a following, it's kind of like I can change the type of clientele I get just by changing the work I post on social media. So I think at this point, I could be wrong, but I think I've been doing pretty much solely food for about a year and a half now. And the clients come in just based on pure, you know, brand awareness, people, creative directors from certain agencies seeing my stuff every single day. So when I get clients at this point, it's almost always I hop on an initial meeting to hear about the scope, and everybody's like, oh, like the, you know, as the creative director, I've followed your work for a while. And like, when we got this project from Oreo or whatever, it fit perfectly. You're the guy. So, I think it's usually that it's people that are creative directors or working at certain agencies or direct to client that have, seen my work and followed it for a while, and they were just like, yeah, it was no question. We see your work every day. It's food. Let's go. So that's one of the better things about specializing in food. It's almost, there's almost no learning curve at this point with clients, because it's like the only thing I do, versus being a generalist. I felt like I was just learning stuff before the project. Like, I hope I can deform this. I hope I can animate this. Now it's just, oh, we got to make like a couple things of candy or whatever. Easy.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Ever thought modern video games should be more interesting? At the Gaming Blender, we take randomized genres, mechanics, and make a new game every episode.
I've added permadeath.
We have a survival game of a hardcore simulation, which could be House Flipper, and with the permadeath of XCOM. Then that all has to be an action adventure.
Yes.
Ooh, dear.
Yes.
And sometimes it doesn't quite work.
And you have a construction off over the course of the narrative.
A construction off? The way we can do this is that we ditch your idea entirely.
Entirely.
Check out the Gaming Blender on all your favorite podcast platforms now.
It's almost like you kind of like switch the tables, right? Because you would usually, as a generalist, try to learn everything and kind of like be mediocre in everything that is out there. And you would be in a position where you would go and have to adapt to every new project that you see, which is kind of like a lot of time, and it's, you know, just kind of like heavy on like your time and the things that you need to do and so on. But here you're in a position where you're kind of like, you're super specialized, you're doing one thing only, but thanks to this visibility, people kind of come to you because I'm sure there are some other people who are doing similar work, but it's all kind of like hidden. It's almost like you have to go and Binance somewhere and kind of like start digging and looking for, and there would be like 100 different images. One of them is going to be food. You know, people don't, and here it's like super on top, very easy to notice. And especially on Instagram, like if they follow you, you're almost always kind of like top of mind. So would you say that these social media experiments, they really paid off in your case, right?
Yeah, 100%. And I agree with you. I think I've seen, you know, a handful of food 3D artists throughout the years. And it's the same thing. It's like, it's either they'll do one every blue moon or they do that, but they have zero following. So it's just hard for them to get their work out. Whereas I've kind of taken the social media route where it's, you know, every time I post, it's like, it's pushing this whole thing to 165,000 people every day. And I took advantage of what a lot of artists don't. A lot of artists, I went to art school, so I saw so many people who kind of didn't believe their work was good enough for posting. Mm. And if they did, they kind of use an alias. Like a lot of artists use, you know, like logos or don't show their face. And I think I took advantage of, you know, putting myself out there, putting my face out there and my voice most recently, to show people that it's like a little bit more engaging. You know, people's like, oh, this is the guy that makes the stuff. And that helps for things when I'm like presenting at the ZBrush Summit and doing Maxon events, they actually know who I am walking through those doors instead of just, oh, that's the guy who makes that. Like I had no idea that's what he looked like. So it's just, I think it's good for everything. Like the brand awareness, from making, all the way from being onboarded to client projects and having creative directors be like, oh yeah, we followed you for so long. Like there's already immediate connection there to presenting at stuff like Maxon events, ZBrush events, and other industry events like that.
Yeah, I want to support this point, and I think you did an amazing job when you kind of like weren't really stopping yourself with posting, because we see a lot of students or people who are junior or just trying out, and they are like, they are so shy, like really, in terms of the work that they want to put on or publish. They're like, no, this is not good enough, or I still need to work on this a little bit more. But you know, like this will never end. Like this will never be perfect. You at this some point you just have to say, okay, it's just going there, and it's a learning process, right? So I think I have actually good friends at Houdini, and one of the guys on the marketing team, he's a photographer, and we talk with him, and I started kind of posting regularly in my Instagram, like just kind of like a picture a day. They're not like amazing, whatever, this is not like art, but it's just, it gives me a certain discipline sort of to push something all the time, right? So, and he says that this is like a perfect way to do it, because no matter what, you're still kind of like upgrading sort of like very gradually. And it's a process, and I think what you did is amazing. Of course, some people would say, oh, this dude was just super lucky or something, or you can't do this on Instagram now because it's like it's all video or something. But at the end of the day, I think it's a great story because you tried and you did it and acted, and you did it regularly. So there was a certain discipline behind, because it's very easy to do it for a couple of takes and then nobody sees it and you're like, you're discouraged and you stop doing it, right? But the challenging thing is just to keep going and trying to dig this and to turn it into something off of business, which you did, which is amazing. I do have like a couple more questions. So first, I don't even like know if it's a question or just kind of like a comment. I think you're doing an amazing thing that you're actually putting your name out there and your face out there. This is again so different from what artists usually do, because right. Even like very big names, like they create something like a, you know, people or something, right? And then, who is that dude? Like, what's going on? And here you have everything. But now that you have this popularity, because you do have quite a lot of followers on Instagram, right? So it's over almost like 170,000. Do people recognize you when you go to restaurants or something? Do they say, hey, this is like I follow you? How is your like, because I think you're at this level now where you can get in, you know, you can go to Nobu somewhere or say, hey, this is an interesting thing. I'm gonna take this idea and turn it into something of mine. Or do these chefs kind of look at your stuff, get inspired? Is there any kind of relationship building over there?
Well, that definitely reminds me. I definitely did a series not too long ago that I haven't worked on too recently, but it was called From Restaurant to Rendering. And I would actually go to Atlanta-based, you know, restaurants and stuff and be like, here's what I'm doing on social media. How about I come to your restaurant and I bring a friend, we get, you know, a meal on the house, and then I kind of put it into a piece of content and we make it a collaboration reel with the restaurant. And 90% of the time they saw it and they're like, this would be great. Like it's, you know, they have access to my engagement and vice versa. And, you know, oftentimes restaurants don't have like the greatest following. So they're always like, wow, this would be cool. This is dope for, you know, anyone's social media team, kind of was raving at that idea. But to answer your question, I've been recognized a few times in public, but definitely not. I think I have a kind of perfect middle ground of recognizability. So like at, you know, Maxon events or ZBrush events, I'll be recognized, but like on a daily life, no way. Like 165K, I think is a good number in the 3D space. That's like I think a pretty big number in our field, but from day-to-day life, that's not like massive fame or anything, which I think is a good thing.
Patrick, so I have to ask you, because you know, food, like we mentioned in the beginning, it's something that you see every day, and there's also a lot of pictures of food online, and which means that there is a lot of material for artificial intelligence to learn how to replicate the pictures of food. So what's your kind of like take on that technology? Where do you think it's going to go? How it's going to develop? You have this kind of like old school workflow where you have Octane, where you have ZBrush. It's kind of like it's very hands-on, although like you have procedural textures and all that stuff. But do you see yourself using some of those tools in the future? Do you think this is the way kind of like 3D is going to evolve? Or maybe there you have another angle. Tell us more.
I think with the AI stuff going on, you know, I use AI for certain things like masking, denoising sometimes, but I have yet to take advantage of like generative stuff in my work, especially client work. And I think it depends on the type of clients you're going for, because a lot of people are scared about jobs being taken away for AI. I can tell you that the type of clients I'm working for, you know, they're at a level of detail to where I don't think anyone would be satisfied with just generating stuff and hoping an image would come out nice. Because a lot of these projects, you know, scene files are wanted, like project files, and the ability to manipulate even one sesame seed. So I don't foresee AI taking over that type of work yet. I mean, AI, I think at this point would be taking over, you know, certain small Fiverr projects or something like that, where clients just kind of want the easy out. But I don't foresee it, nor do I think it would be a good thing if AI takes over like what should be a human-made process. I think that's, and you know, maybe I'm biased to a degree, but you know, you think of things that shouldn't be so optimized, like not everything, including art. Like I feel like the art in general is made to kind of awe at how a human made it, and it shouldn't always be about, you know, just the fastest way, like making it super press a button and it's done. Like it's about the process. So I think I don't think AI is going to do anything too crazy. Now it is an exponentially growing thing, so who knows? It's the worst it will ever be right now. But we'll see.
Kind of like a lot of photographers, they actually think that 3D is taking a lot of their work, right? So, but if you think about product photography or food photography, it's almost like they're, well, I used to do it with like a bunch of cameras and lights and kind of like, and now you're doing this and on a computer. And I think people have kind of the same mindset when they think about AI. And it's, I think it's scary because you really don't know where it's going, right? So you don't really, it's evolving so fast, like you said. It's very hard to figure out, okay, what's going to be the next step, sort of. But at the same time, it's also exciting. Like, we have this opportunity to learn one more time and kind of like try to find the next step. To kind of wrap this up, if there's like a younger you somewhere in a university or a school, or a person who's just trying to learn 3D or try to do something of their work, what would be like the three things you would say to them? Like something not to fear, or maybe something to pursue, or just general recommendations?
Yeah, any kind of hobby that you're interested in, I would dive into in your free time. If you're in somewhere like a school, I would collaborate with everyone from like different majors. I think that was something that separated me pretty early on. You know, most artists are kind of sticking in their own lane, don't like talking to too many people outside their circle. And I was kind of always bouncing, oh, this is the fashion majors, this is the film majors, this is, you know, making friends with all these people. Because when we all graduate, a lot of these people are starting their own companies, startups, or working at different corporations that could use your services later. So I think it's very beneficial to just make friends with all different types of walks of life and, you know, follow the rabbit holes. That, and don't get discouraged right off the bat if stuff doesn't work out. Like, oh, I posted this render, it didn't go viral, like, I'm just going to do something else. Like, even after 2 months, 5 months, a year even, you know, stuff sometimes doesn't pop off for a whole year or two of posting stuff. So that's where it really comes down to. If you're enjoying it, keep doing it. If you just feel like it's just work and you're just doing it to go viral and do all that stuff, that's when it really feels like work. And that's when you're going to get discouraged and kind of try to give up. So make sure the thing that you're doing every single day, it's something you actually care about and would do if you weren't making money. That was this. Like, when I was starting 3D, I just, at the end of my film classes, I saw that at the editing bays, they had Cinema 4D, and I learned it just because I thought it was fun. It definitely wasn't a career move, and it definitely wasn't, oh, hopefully I can go viral. I don't even think that was a thing back in the day. It's like 2016. So I would just say those three things. Follow your passions or your hobbies, collaborate with different people in different respective majors or industries, and don't give up after, you know, a few months of stuff not working out. Because I feel like long term, you watch interviews, every success story is, oh, I almost quit, like I was just about to give up. So those would be the three pieces of advice.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for enjoying another episode of the 80 Level Roundtable podcast. Check out upcoming episodes on the 80 Level website at 80.lv. Join our career site at 80.lv/RFP. And share our podcast with friends and on your social networks.